You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
I invite you to join me as we explore new ideas. I'm David Bryan. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. And today, what a pleasure. I am with Crystal Hickman. It is not necessarily a name that everybody would know, although they probably should. But Crystal is a community scientist, a photographer, a writer, and an extraordinary documenter, largely through photographs, but not only through photographs, of bees, of the world of bees. And so welcome, Crystal, and thank you for being willing to spend a little time and educate us about this very small, well, not minuscule, but small and fascinating territory. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, well, that's good. That means your life is not very exciting.
Oh, okay. All right. I guess maybe, I don't know, I'll lower my excitement a little bit.
There we go. I don't want you to be disappointed.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Thanks for preparing me.
Okay. So, and you should say, and I will tell you, your book, is this your first book? I'm assuming
it is.
It is. Yeah. I know there's more to come. Your book, The ABCs of California Native Bees. The pictures are stunning. Pictures are stunning. Crystal is a photographer, as I said. And you do, which was, I know I had heard the term, I wasn't exactly sure what it meant, but you do macro photography. So you blow up, the bees are larger than life.
Yeah, they're larger than life in the photos for sure. So yeah, macro photography, you take pictures of really small things and make them look very big.
Yeah, it's exquisite, and the bees are exquisite. And I wonder, I mean, do you run into sort of bee bigotry? Like people, you say bees and they go, oh, bees. I don't like bees, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah. That's actually it's funny. Cause that's one of the first responses I get because everyone's worried about being stung by them.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I don't like bees. They sting me. Or they tell me some like traumatic childhood story of when they stepped on a bee or walked past a beehive. But it's always really funny too, because most of the time it's honeybees. And I'm like, well, I don't actually work with honeybees. I work with native bees. So they have stingers as well, but they rarely ever sting people. So you don't really have to worry about being stung.
And so there's a distinction. Honeybees versus other bees. Native bees? What I mean is there's many, many different strains of bees. I know that.
Yeah, there are.
So what's the distinction? But what, like honeybees is one particular slice of the bee world?
There are one particular very, very small slice of the bee world. So at the moment, I think there's about 8 species of honeybees currently in existence. The ones that are in the U.S. are Apis mellifera. They're from Europe. So they were brought over here along with colonization in 1622, but there are over 20,000 species of bees in the world. So honeybees, those eight individual species.
Eight out of 20,000.
Yeah, they only make up like 0.04% of all bee species. So they have really good, I say they have like a really good advertising, because like when people think of bees, they think of those bees, but there's
and
quite
what
a few
distinguishes
more.
What distinguishes honeybees? I mean, I get that they're a different species, so their chromosomes and genes distinguish them. But do they're called honeybees? At least you know the non-scientific name. But do all bees make honey, or only honeybees?
Sort of. So honeybees, They're called honeybees just because they store honey and they're known as the ones who make honey. So they're eusocial. So they live in a hive. There's a queen. There's multiple generations at a time. There's even a caste system. But they visit flowers and they collect nectar and they store it in an internal crop and they regurgitate it into cells in their hive. And all honey really is, basically, it's a little bit more complicated than this, but it's nectar that has had a lot of the moisture removed. So all adult bees eat nectar. And there are some bees, when you are out on the hot day, you'll see them with like a little bubble in their mouth. They're blowing a bubble of nectar. It's called concentrating nectar. So they're evaporating the moisture content of the nectar and making their own personal honey. And there's some other bees that are eusocial as well, like bumblebees. There's also stingless bees. They make honey that tastes a little bit different than honeybees, but yeah.
Did you say stingless bees?
Yeah, which is kind of ironic because they actually have stingers. Their stingers are just too small to sting people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they're called stingless.
But why? So you don't work with honeybees. Well, you don't
work with honeybees.
You tend not to photograph honeybees. But why? Why not?
So I love native bees because they have relationships with the ecosystems that I visit. So honeybees, they're managed a lot of the times. People will have them in a beehive in their backyard, or people will put them next to a farm in a beehive there. But the native bees, they evolved alongside the flowers that they visit. So they are part of a healthy biodiverse ecosystem. So they're like one link that helps maintain the ecosystem. And I absolutely love them because sometimes you can identify the plants by the bee that's visiting them and vice versa. They also help maintain the balanced ecosystem as well by pollinating the flowers. There's also really fascinating bees. Some of them are parasites of other bees. And I just love looking for those relationships out in nature. Hmm. I think it's really fascinating. They're part of the ecosystem. You can also tell the health of an ecosystem by their change in numbers. So if their population increases, decreases, or is stable, you can tell what's happening in the ecosystem around them.
Hmm. And I don't want to belabor this, but I'm not quite. Are honeybees in some ways detrimental to the ecosystem or detrimental to the native bees?
Yeah, so they're actually detrimental to native pollinators. The honeybees that are in the U.S., they're actually a combination of multiple subspecies, but they're all Apis mellifera. So it's multiple European subspecies and then one African subspecies. So I think there's about 9 subspecies in Africa, but we just have one of them. So the honeybees, they can actually show up very early in the morning when it's cooler because of their European genes, but they can also stay out when it's much warmer. I've seen them out when it's like 120 degrees outside. Oh. And they could stay out through the evening as well. And what that actually does with competition with the native pollinators is a lot of them, I'll just stick with native bees, they'll show up at certain temperatures. So there are ones that show up at dusk and dawn, but there are other ones that show up when the sun is high. They need that heat because they're cold-blooded. So if we have these honeybees that are non-native, not part of the ecosystem, showing up right when the sun rises and taking all the resources, the native pollinators or the native creatures that rely on those same resources to survive have to go elsewhere. And on years when there's limited resources like droughts, and California, where I live, has been having droughts quite a bit in the last few years, you really see the impact that honeybees are having on native pollinators. And it's also really interesting too, because honeybees, they can travel like about a 2-mile radius from their hive. So they can travel really far.
Is that, yeah. That's far for a bee.
That's really far. And then, but some native bees I've seen, they'll create a little burrow in the ground right under the flower they're visiting. So some of them don't travel really far at all. But and it's just, it's a lot of competition with these non-native pollinators.
So did the introduction of honeybees into the environment diminish the population of various native bees? where they show up? I mean, do they always win? You know what I mean?
I wouldn't say they always win. And I would say it is more so in drought years when you definitely notice the impact. But they do just seem to be out competing the native pollinators in most cases. But yeah, they definitely do have a negative impact. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're used in farming so much is because, specifically talk about Central Valley, California, a lot of the native habitat has been removed. So they don't have, a lot of these native pollinators don't have the habitat to visit. So if you bring in a non-native bee that doesn't rely on the habitat and you put it next to crops, it'll visit those crops. It doesn't need the habitat to survive like native bees do, even though actually I've been visiting farms and I've started seeing native bees and a lot of other native pollinators there as well, which I think is really interesting.
Okay, so honeybees many native bees, this is a question, many native bees only can get their food from particular plants?
Exactly. Wow. So it's called a symbiotic relationship or a specialist relationship. So it's actually food for the baby bees that causes a symbiotic relationship. So it's the pollen they're collecting. So nectar is for the adult bees and pollen is for the baby bees. And the females will purposely collect pollen from certain flowers and then they'll take it back to, it could be their hive, it could be their burrow, a cavity that they're nesting in. And they'll create a little like kind of pollen pillow that they'll lay an egg on. And when that egg hatches, the larva will start to consume the pollen provisioned by their mother.
Mm. And you know, growing up, or maybe it's just cartoons or something, how people learn about bees, but you know, there's always this, they live in hives or they live in a collective form, right? Yeah. And they have different, you know, there's worker bees and there's the queen bee and there's blah, blah, blah. And is that not true for all bees? Do all bees live collectively? That's not, or no?
No, it's actually 90% of bees are solitary.
No kidding.
So, so I like to compare it to, like, I'd say a bird expert is an ornithologist.
Yeah.
And when you talk to an ornithologist, instead of talking to them about possibly rare and endangered birds, you talk to them about chickens. And then you apply facts about chickens to all birds. So the same thing applies to bee experts who are militologists. It's like, instead of calling a militologist a bee expert, you call a beekeeper, which is basically the equivalent of a chicken farmer.
Oh, a chicken farmer.
And then, you apply facts that just apply to honeybees to all of the other 20,000 plus species.
Right.
When, again, it's less than 0.5% of honeybees like that, yeah.
You're obviously very knowledgeable about bees, and so I want to circle back for a second to where I started, which that you call yourself, you are a citizen scientist. So, for people not familiar with that term, what does that actually mean?
Yeah. So, actually, now I call myself a community scientist, Yeah. So citizen scientist historically means that you don't have a degree in the field that you're studying. But because of politically the last few years, it changed to whether or not you have documents. So your status here in the United States. So to be more inclusive, we've started calling ourselves community scientists because there are a lot of people from all over the world in the United States who are doing citizen or community science. So, yeah.
And what makes it science?
Makes it science. It's you know what's kind of funny? It's anyone could contribute to science. A lot of times people think like you have to be in like a white lab coat, looking through a microscope, something like that. Like that's normally what people picture. But you can literally just be out there with your cell phone taking photos of things. So what I do specifically is I've learned how to photograph bees in a way that I could identify a lot of them to species through photos. So there's no collecting. But also since I'm out there sitting and observing them, I am documenting new behaviors. So I've documented about 8 new behaviors. In the US, I've photographed, I think, about 15 species. I have the first photos of living representatives of them, and in the world, about 20 species. So yeah, science, there's not one way to do it. It's me, it's taking photos of rare endangered bees. I've also expanded the known range of a bunch of creatures of them. And then some of them that are parasites, I've identified what their host species is for the first time, and documented new behaviors. But if you want to be a community scientist as well, you can honestly just go in your own backyard, because there's bees that will live in an ecosystem that you create in your backyard, and you can make amazing new behavioral discoveries. If you have plants that are native to your ecosystem, you might have specialist relationships that show up as well. And just take photos and document those things, because you never know what kind of new discoveries you might make.
And can we talk about that for a second? I mean, I think you're right. I think people think of scientists frequently in a laboratory, et cetera. And yes, some of them do spend time in labs.
Oh, definitely.
But there is that sense that, you know, they are the know-all, be-all, and that's the only way one can know something is to have the paper that goes along with it. And that's clearly not the case. I mean, I know you collaborate with scientists, with trained, with degreed scientists from various universities, various institutions that study, well, in this case, bees. How did you do that? Right? I mean, people want to know, right? I mean, people want to, like, you know, because most people, well, when I grow up, I want to be an entomologist, and so I'm going to go study in a biology department, and I'm going to study entomology and blah, blah, blah. But that's not the path you took. But did you set out to do that? Could you? I mean, I know we spoke briefly about this, but I think that's a fascinating piece of, especially since the work you do is in that world, very important. Mm-hmm. And so folks, I think that's a fascinating piece of your work, is how you got there.
Yeah. I guess I'll just start out with how I initially made the contact. But so I do astrophotography as well as bee photography. And I was in Death Valley. And when I was driving back, I saw this flower that I'd never seen before. It's called an Areogonum inflatum. So it's a buckwheat. Really beautiful flower. It's on a very small stalk. It looks kind of like a star. It's yellow. And on this flower, I saw a bee called a Perdita nasuta. And it was a bee that had never been seen alive before. And I think since I had the first observation, I think before that, it hadn't been seen since the 50s. Mm-hmm. And this bee had a facial feature on it. It's called a clypeus. The males have it. It looks like sort of a duckbill. And because of the way a lot of melittology or bee science is done, they basically pan trap bees. So they'll put out a dish or plates, and there's some liquid in there. Potentially anything that flies by will land in it, drown, and their bodies are studied in a lab later. But because I was taking photos, I actually photographed the male bee using that clypeus facial feature, and no one knew what that feature was for before I actually photographed them using it. And there was a man who is a expert in that genus. His name is Zachary Portman. I reached out to him, and he was the one who told me, hey, you photographed a bee that had never been photographed alive before. You also documented a symbiotic relationship and a new behavior. And through talking with him, one thing that I realized pretty quickly was that if you talk to someone who has such a niche interest, no one really is like reaches out to them about it. They get really excited when you reach out to them. So he was just very enthusiastically responding, and just, we had a really great conversation. And I think this was back in like 2020. And since then, we've just been talking very regularly. But I've found that just in all areas of science, if you, because I found even a moth, a really rare moth in Red Rock in California City. And there was one guy who was an expert in it, just really enthusiastically responded. And that's what all of these people do when you reach out to them. But yeah, since then initially, because of what I was doing, like it was very different. Some of the scientists who'd been working in the labs, they were like, oh, well, you're not actually contributing to science because you're not collecting these bees to identify them. But since then, since they've seen my photos, some of them have actually started to ID bees through photos instead of collecting. A lot of them are still collecting as well, and I still definitely value that work. But it's changed the way a lot of scientists have started to view community science. And because of that, they've been inviting me to their universities. Like I've spoken at like Harvard, UCLA, a bunch of different colleges, and talked to them about community science, different ways to ID bees, and just different ways to contribute to science. So I think it's really evolving because of, even if you don't have like a fancy camera, you can go out with a cell phone as well.
I'm trying to figure out where the roots come from, right? I mean, did you grow up fascinated by and sort of diving into the biological names of things that crawl?
No, but I did like to stare at them a lot. So I was always one of those kids who was on the ground in the dirt staring at ants or like lady beetles. I love butterflies. I just love being outside, birds. Yeah. Honestly, everything outside was really interesting. But with identifying bees, it's honestly just kind of a puzzle. You figure out what you need to look at, and a lot of times you can figure out what the bees are to. I would start with family initially, and then you can get to genus, and then you can get to species after that.
I'm so curious about that piece because, you know, a lot of people just take pictures because they're pretty.
Yeah.
But you were looking for, I mean, and I think if you, well, maybe this isn't true. I'm about to say something that's probably not true. But I think people go out into their gardens or they get out into the yard or they go out into the woods and, you know, bees are bees. They're not identifying that. Wait a minute. That bee is different from that bee. I mean, there's some obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Big old bumblebees are different from honeybees and then those look like wasps. So I'm not going near them and all that sort of stuff. But you were fascinated enough to dive more deeply, which I think is
Definitely.
That's your secret sauce right there.
It is. And just, I think being really detailed oriented as well. So like a lot of times too, I think people can kind of start to open their eyes when they look at different wasps or they look at different flies or bees, and then they start to be able to tell them apart.
Mm-hmm.
They could look at different facial features or body features or the wing finish and like the way the veins lie in their wings and go, wait, I could tell these creatures apart just by looking at them. And I feel like that maybe opens a door to them looking closer.
Do all bees, I think everybody, well, I don't know about everybody, but a lot of people know about the, you know, the supposedly the communication that goes on among bees where they do the dance and they dance for their neighbors so that they can identify where hey, there's a good stash of pollen over there. I'm assuming not all bees do that.
No, that's honeybees.
That is entirely honeybees.
As far it's as amazing. I'm aware, that's just honeybees. Yeah, that's called the waggle dance. But yeah,
the waggle dance. That's the scientific name for it.
It's a name for it.
Yeah, I think so. I think so too.
Yeah.
Have you bumped into other community scientists who are studying other things?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's it's funny because. You could kind of just spot them by one, they're out in nature, but also they're standing in the same place for a very long time. So I'll stand by a bush for like days just to see what everything's on it. But
did you say days?
Yeah. but like some birders, you'll see them just standing somewhere with binoculars or a very long lens staring at the same spot. Or they're pretty easy to spot. I've actually run into like so many really fascinating people by just looking for bees. And I've run into just fly people. I think flies are amazing as well. Because a lot of times, you know, it's funny because where you look for birds, that's also a really good place to look for bees, but also the same thing with flies as well. I know if I see a lot of flies early in the morning, because a lot of them will fly out earlier than bees, I'm like, okay, this is a good spot for bees as well.
Are there conventions or are there gatherings of community scientists?
There are gatherings of community scientists too. And there's apps like iNaturalist. I've actually made friends through iNaturalist because I've noticed, oh, these people like bees a lot too. Or there's someone who's seen a bee that I'm looking for and it's a rare bee. Or there's a bee that has a relationship with a certain flower and I'm waiting for that flower to bloom. So then I'll reach out to someone who's seen that flower that time of year and go, hey, is it still flowering? Or do you see this flower? Like, what time of year do you see this flower specifically? If I don't know. And I've gotten to locations because of that.
So is it, you know how bird watchers are, they're sort of gathering, they always walk around with a small book and they hear something or they see something and they write down what it is they think mm-hmm. they saw or heard and where yeah. and when. And is that, so, because you just said you were looking for a particular bee. Mm-hmm. And why?
Well, for a while, it was because of this book that I was making. So I was trying to get every letter in the alphabet. So I was like, okay, I had a list of bees. And if I was missing a letter, I was like, okay, let me find out as much information about this bee as possible. But also, I just like being out in nature too. So if I'm in a new sort of like micro ecosystem, I'm really curious about what flowers are there. Mm-hmm. And because of those flowers, I'm curious what bee might show up as well.
So there are some bees that just, that's it. That's just this flower and loyal to this flower.
Yeah. So like the Perdita nasuta that I was talking about before, you can identify that bee to species by the flower that it visits. So it only visits the Areogonum inflatum. You see a Perdita on that flower. That's what that bee is.
That's what that is.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's wild.
So, yeah, I mean, you could take all the identification photos, but you could also just look at the flower.
Okay. So it strikes me that, you know, you obviously have learned a lot about bees in this endeavor. And we're going to go talk about your book in a second, but have you learned other things about?
Yeah.
So you've learned a lot about bees. Have you learned about yourself or the world or in addition to that, from studying bees?
You know, what's funny is I feel like I have, regarding myself, I found that I really like quiet and I really like sitting in places where there's no one else around and just being disconnected from things. But it's funny how somehow that led to me having like more friendships or more people to talk to than I've like ever had in my life, because I post a lot of my stuff on Instagram or Facebook and then my website, and just people started reaching out to me and they were like, can I join you? And for some reason, just people who love ecology are some of the best people that I've ever met and some of the most passionate people that I've ever met. I really love spending time with them even when I'm like just out in nature, because a lot of them just like to sit in quiet as well, which I really enjoy.
So do you take people, you said they, you know, can I join you? Do you sometimes take people out with you to do this, teach them, or at least show them what you do, et cetera?
Yeah, definitely. So I show them what I do, but a lot of times, since they're in ecology as well, I'll learn things from them also. Geology, a lot of my friends are into plants, birds. One of my best friends is into birds. Absolutely love flies and wasps. Yeah, a lot of it's just on the fly as well. 'Cause like one day I couldn't go to sleep. Probably have an insomnia. But instead of just like turning on the TV and watching Netflix, I was like, you know what? I'm going to drive to the desert. So I drove like 4 or 5 hours out to the desert. Didn't check the weather at all. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have gone. But it started raining. And because it was raining, I was sitting on these like giant rocks, and this desert tortoise, this endangered desert tortoise, just started scaling this rock. And I'd been wanting to see one for years.
Oh,
And
wow.
because I had that experience, I realized that desert tortoises come out when it starts raining. So that was just like a random experience that led to a little new bit of knowledge that I didn't have before. So yeah, it's just like being out in nature leads to new experiences and new knowledge. And yeah.
And do you always have this passion for nature? You know, like as a kid, you just always
Yeah.
lived there.
I feel like it was funny too, because I remember as like a toddler, so we just had like a green grass lawn, but then we had rose bushes, and that was like my whole nature world. So there were like spiders there were box elder bugs, lady beetles, and yeah, that was my nature, and it got a little bit bigger as I got older.
It certainly got bigger. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you travel far and wide to, I mean, you, so you just said you drove 4 or 5 hours out into the desert, but have you gone to exotic places specifically to see bees that you would not find elsewhere?
I travel all over the world. So I started out in Mexico, and then South America, and I visit Australia once a year, and obviously different states like continental and Hawaii as well. And gonna go to a couple of different countries or different new continents, I guess, next year.
And it's
Yeah.
the trips are quite specifically to
Find bees.
identify, you'd find bees, of
Yeah,
course.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anything else I find along the way is also really amazing. I just got back from Australia last month, actually, and I was in Cooktown in Queensland, so the
Yeah.
eastern side of Australia.
Yeah.
And there's a bee that there's actually three bees there that are the same size as Perdita minima, which is the smallest known bee in North America. It's a little under 2 millimeters. It's about 1.8 millimeter,
That's
the size
very
of a
small.
letter and a quarter. Yeah, and there's three of them in Cooktown area that all have the exact same phenology. They almost look identical. They live about, I'd say, 12 meters up eucalyptus trees, or about 40 feet. And they're just really tiny. And only one person has ever collected them or actually seen them. And he collected them in once in 1978 and again in 1988. So I went there to find them. My net was too short. It was 6 meters, so it only got like 20 feet up the tree. But everything I don't kill anything. I just like collect them in the net and then let them go. But
Yeah.
everything that I caught in the net was an undescribed species. So that was really cool.
Wow, that's great. That's amazing, actually. It's
Yeah. So,
so so wait,
look
so
for other things.
you collect them with the net, bring them down, take pictures, and then let them go. Yeah,
Yeah, and
that's hilarious.
it's yeah, and it's I'm sure like a lot of people would be frustrated with me for those specifically, because right now the way people ID things to species or identify a new species is through collecting it, and they look at the different features, they measure things, and then they describe them, and then that's how they identify it as a new species and give it a name. But I'm just taking photos of them and letting them go.
Yeah.
So they might just stay undescribed, but there's photos of them alive and we know that they're there.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, that's the thing. You collect them and let them go, and so we know they're alive. If somebody collects them and kills them, we don't know if that was the last one.
It's interesting too, because there was a bee that I saw in California, actually. It was so rare that it's not in a lot of labs, or as far as I'm aware anyway. But I saw three individuals, and that's it. So there's photos online of living representatives of this species, even though most people haven't seen them in labs. But I was talking to the person who's an expert in that genus, and she wanted to know where I found them. And I wouldn't tell her because I know she was going to send someone out there to collect them. But I was like, there's literally three of them. I mean, there could have been more of them, but that's literally all I saw.
There could have been more of them, but there might not be.
Yeah, and like, what if someone put out a pan trap and they caught all three of them? So yeah, there's definitely things we can learn from collecting them and them being in a lab. And honestly, I wouldn't have been able to identify the bees or a lot of other creatures that I'm identifying the species without those museum collections or those lab collections. But yeah, I think it'd be great if maybe there was that changed in the future. We could
Leave
start to
them
identify
alone.
new species just through photos, which I think eventually is going to be possible.
Well, I want to make sure that we speak about the book. So could you talk a bit about the ABCs of California native bees? And it's specifically California.
It is. It's just California. So I was talking to one of my friends, Olivia Messinger Carroll, who's another bee person, and she actually counted all of the bees in California. There's 1,643 species. So California has 8% of all the bee species in the world. And what I saw, like, just that is so high, I first wondered, can I photograph a letter for every single letter in the alphabet, a bee for every letter in the alphabet? And I went to this website called Discover Life, which listed all of the known bees, or most of them at least, in a bunch of different states. You can look all over the world, but I looked specifically in California, and I was like, I think I can do this. So I set out just to photograph them, and then a couple of years into photographing them, the idea turned to like making a book, because one of the places that I had been visiting really regularly, it was in the Santa Monica Mountains, and this was the third year of a drought. So people who lived in the area had asked a certain conservancy to do fire abatement, which basically meant cut down a lot of the plants, which meant native plants, which were plants, the bees that I was photographing were visiting. So this little just turn off where people just park and maybe take photos, that's where I'd been spending about 6 months. And they cut down all the plants and the bees disappeared, and none of them have come back since then. And I realized I hadn't taken any photos of what the area looked like before all the plants were cut down. And that had actually been something I was running into pretty regularly. I was looking at historical records for these bees, and I would look at Google Maps and I would see there was a neighborhood there, or there was a building or a parking lot. So the habitats that these bees lived in was gone. It was being fragmented or habitat loss. So then I was like, you know what? I'm gonna change these into stories instead of just something personally for me. I'm gonna change it into something other people can look at and hopefully learn from as well. So I started taking landscape photos and photos of the plants that they had relationships with, and then also a lot of the other creatures that were also in the habitat as well. It was like the desert tortoise. But yeah, so I thought it'd be interesting to tell about the history of the land, the history of the plants, current information about the bees. And it was just kind of like, when you read through the book, I feel like very easy reading, even though there's a lot of scientific names in there. But it's a journey people can take with me through all of these different ecosystems in California. So it's deserts, it's mountain ranges, it's islands, farms. The UB is on a farm, backyards. And it's stories about fire abatement, competition with honeybees. But yeah, it's there's a lot of positive stories. There's some stories that don't have the best endings, just because of what happens to the area that the bees lived in. But yeah, it's a love letter to California, and One thing that I think is really fascinating too is California, the bee diversity, it's on par with countries like Argentina and France, and where we almost have the same amount of bee species as continents like Australia. So they have 1,700, we have 1,643 species. So what's happening in California is a reflection of what's happening globally, because we have so many different ecosystems.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's why I wanted to tell this story. But yeah.
Okay, so somebody hears this and they say, geez, bees, and I don't want them to be destroyed. I don't want them to lose their habitat. What can anybody do to help?
Yeah, if you have a yard, plant native plants. Plant plants that are native to your area.
That area.
You can go to websites like the Audubon Society, and they have a zip code search. So you can put in your zip code and it'll tell you plants that are native to your area. Now the Audubon Society is for birds, but you can find birds will visit the native plants as well. So it also benefits the bees. So that's another thing too, that's really important to highlight, is if you want to save the bees, you do need to save the native plants, but it's also everything in their ecosystem as well. So that can mean things that we don't necessarily like. So like the wasps, like the flies, the spiders, the thrips, the aphids, things like that. All of those creatures, all of those animals are important to have a healthy biodiverse ecosystem. And I like to compare it to like a Jenga game, like, you know, that game with the wooden blocks. At the beginning of the game, it's really steady and secure, but you start removing the blocks and displacing them, putting them.
Good.
Yeah. Medicine. And it starts to, yeah. And those blocks are those things like the aphids, like the thrips, but it's also healthy water. It's fungi. It's the bees. It's the birds, things like that. So you need all of them to have a really steady tower, a steady ecosystem. So that's something you can create in your yard. So if you have a yard, maybe think of replacing that green lawn with native ecosystem that matches what the ecosystem looked like before your neighborhood was put there. So I think anyone could help by just creating a habitat or reintroducing a habitat.
Yeah. Well, just to let you know, since our last conversation, and inspired actually by our last conversation, I dug, there was a corner of the backyard. It's not really the backyard, but whatever. that it was just lawn. It was just, the whole thing was lawn. And I hand dug a very large semicircle of a garden that, well, it's not planted yet because, well, winter's coming and that's not the place. Our first snow, as I told you before. And so thank you for that clue. And I will make sure it is the native plant garden.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's amazing.
Thank you. So.
Oh my gosh. Okay. We have to stay in touch and let me, I would love to see what you see.
Okay.
Take photos and.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think I told you last time I grew up, I think because I had gotten stung so often, and, you know, I don't know if they just liked me or if I was, you know, just walking unconsciously or whatever. I got stung so many times. I hated bees. They scared me. I wasn't allergic or anything until I ended up in a field of bees and they were buzzing all around. I didn't realize it. And suddenly it was like, oh my God. And then, you know, I incorrectly had this story that, well, when bees sting, they lose their stinger and they die. And so what kind of a creature would die for no reason? And it just calmed me right down. Turns out I was only talking about honeybees.
Yeah, just honeybees. But yeah, they're protecting their home.
They're protecting their home. And I will say, you know, one of the things that I've noticed over the years is that, and even wasps, wasps can be more aggressive than bees, but only if they feel threatened. Yeah. So there's not, you know, walking through a garden with bees all around is actually a lovely experience.
It is. Yeah. And honestly, most of them just ignore you too.
Yeah,
they're going about their day. They have things to do. as it were.
So,
Well,
Crystal Hickman, is there anything else to say? And again, I will put up that book and I'll put up your website and your Instagram. And is there anything else we should say before we stop this conversation? And other than I remain dazzled by your work. And
I appreciate that.
And now I'm gonna do my best to take pictures so I can send you those pictures of what's growing, of what's buzzing around my garden.
What's exactly? Yeah. No, honestly, I just want people to take away from this, like, the same thing you did. Just hold space, or just create space for the animals in the world around us.
Indeed.
And it's just, I think too, with bees, like, one of the reasons people like honeybees is so much is because they directly benefit us through farming, without the native ecosystems around them, or like a lot of people like honey. But native bees, I think just the fact that they're here, they took maybe millions, maybe hundreds of thousands of years. Whether or not they directly benefit us, that doesn't mean that they're not important, that they shouldn't be here. So I think it's really important to start valuing things in nature, not just for what they can do for people, but just because they're here.
Well, and you spoke briefly about it, but you know, the assumption, I mean, we think we can identify the ways that something benefits us. So if I love honey, which I don't particularly, but so if I love honey and I know that this bee gives me honey, then it benefits me. But like you said before, you know, there are other things that come along with the plants that the way they sustain the environment may be invisible to you or to me. And that doesn't mean you're not deriving benefit from it. It just means you're not aware of what the benefit is. So
sometimes it just takes a few more steps to get to people, but yeah, we don't know. But
exactly.
Yeah.
So, well, Crystal Hickman, the ABCs of California native bees, thank you so much for being willing to spend some time and educate me about this and inspire me. Now I can't wait till the season goes back to planting season so I can plant native plants. So
yeah.
You take care.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.